In part two, we discuss with Brendan metamodernism and how it is a evolutionary response to some of the problems with postmodernism, where postmodernism deconstructs, metamodernism reconstructs and brings back meaning and the beauty of reality to us once again. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit. Life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution. I wanted to ask you historically, because in the integral circles where we would look at the emergence of the postmodern or the green, there would also be very positive things, such as that gentleman up on my shoulder here, Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, this egalitarian movement, the environmental movement, the cultural revolution of the 60s. These guys here helped the music, which a lot of it, you know, Paperback Writer, A Day in the Life could be seen as very postmodern poetry or thought or music. And how do you fit that? And of course, that was, there were a lot of things going on, but it was young white people being turned on to black music and psychedelics and black people standing up and saying no more. Yeah. And a lot of things all came together, but how would that fit into this idea of cultural evolution and the postmodern?
Yeah, I mean, so that's a great question. And it's interesting, too, whenever you try to give a quick sort of heuristic overview of these things, you're always going to leave out certain key aspects. So thanks for that helpful kind of corrective. I wouldn't want to suggest that any of these worldviews is like, you know, fully good or fully bad. They're just, you know, they have these insights and they have these deficits that both have to be taken into account. So yeah, you're naming a lot of the really valuable insights that came from that postmodern moment. And I think the way of making that meaningful connection is to say that modernity had a very kind of one size fits all. This is the absolute truth. This is the one answer to everything. And, you know, had the blind spot, let's say, of recognizing that the people advocating for that absolute truth and absolute reason tended to be white, male, European, you know, wealthy, etc. So there was a blind spot to other perspectives and to especially the communities that had been marginalized and oppressed by the very modern project itself. And so, I mean, you can also, maybe a great example of this is the story of America in its sort of founding itself, right? Which tends to be told from the perspective of the pilgrims coming from Europe and finding this lush land and all this, and then building this great nation. And there's some degree of truth to that narrative. But what it leaves out, of course, is that there was already a very rich, diverse culture of indigenous peoples here already in this land that were sometimes intentionally genocided, in other ways unintentionally, but basically a history of violence and bloodshed and oppression.
Postmodernism brought that forward.
Exactly. And it drew attention to that there was this whole other aspect outside of the ken of this modern story of progress that we needed to take seriously. And if you read people like Howard Zinn or his book, like The People's History of the United States, that sort of a thing, it tells that angle. So a lot of the civil rights movement in that moment in the 60s was this explosion of appreciation, if that's a weird way of putting that, but there's sort of uprising of appreciation and the surge of awareness that the one size fits all narrative of modernity was not fitting all these other folks and was actually kind of stamping over them towards progress. And so there is this broadening of perspectives to try to account for that, to deal with it, to try to bring these people in. And I shouldn't say it's obviously not only coming from a Western perspective, it's those people themselves advocating for themselves and saying, hey, we're standing up against this system. The system has become a sort of issue of awareness that people recognize that they're living in a particular social system that isn't benefiting them, that isn't serving them, and they are exercising their rights and speaking out against that. And so, yeah, I mean, similarly, you could say things about kind of the Vietnam War resistance and a lot of that there was a sense of pushback against the modern notion of more progress, more industrialization, kind of more spread of political power throughout the globe, this sort of a thing. And people started focusing more on marginal and oppressed groups and what was being left out of the system, something like that. So I think that's certainly one way of telling all these stories. Obviously, and I usually say this at the outset, but you know, these are very complex, interwoven dynamics going on in history that we have to speak of using heuristics, and we can have better or less ways of thinking about. And there are different ways of accounting for a lot of this, but I find this to be a very compelling one and probably the best. And so from the perspective that you're raising, you can then see that, again, as part of this move into the postmodern moment, it was an expansion of consciousness, you could say, an expansion of awareness and moral sensitivity to other groups of people, and the concern that if we are actually going to do this quote unquote universal thing together, then, you know, we actually need to be genuinely diverse and pluralistic and not just hegemonic and kind of singular.
And that brings us to the title of your book, Metamodernism. Yeah. So out of, or as a reaction to, as you point out, and you keep pointing out to your credit, many ways of looking at these things, but next came metamodernism. And perhaps since we've tied this cultural evolution so beautifully to your own story and to John's story, perhaps you might say how you moved into your metamodern phase.
Sure. Yeah. So,
okay, could I ask you, Brendan, did you get, when you were in the academic world, and Roger, you can respond to this too, did you get a lot of metamodernism in the academic variety that we're talking about?
In medical school, John, they're not even up to postmodernism. Come on.
Yeah, none of this was being spoken about at all. In the academic context, I did get a lot of postmodernism, though, for sure. I was an RA for 3 years. And basically, as part of that, there was a whole RA training that was...
RA is...
resident advisor. It's sort of students who live on campus, but are the go-to person for people in their dorms and that sort of a thing. So there was the university administrative apparatus was deeply postmodern, very influenced by and concerned with issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the kinds of workshops that go on around that. And so I got a heaping dose of that, many, many hours of DEI training and that sort of a thing. And a lot of that's still playing out in the university context that we see, which are saturated, you know, in a very profound way at the moment with postmodern thought. For me, it began actually also the way that culturally you could say it began, which is with the arts. I was, as I said, was looking into trying to understand modernism and postmodernism. When I was studying postmodern art, so much of it just did not resonate with me. Obviously, it itself is diverse. There were certain aspects that I grew up with that certainly were...
Can you give some examples of the art you're talking about?
Yeah, sure. So some of the things that I did grow up with that actually I did like were some of the films that would be called postmodern, like Fight Club, American Beauty, Falling Down, these like dark, gritty critiques of kind of suburban American affluent culture that and all of its consumerism and whatnot, and this sort of superficiality of it. There's a lot about postmodernism that is both, that includes its own critique, you could say. And so the critique aspects of it resonated with me very much. But the other things that didn't were the ways that the critique was itself ultimately just a continuation of the very processes it was trying to critique. So what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of postmodern art was reflecting on the fact that culture had become very flattened, superficial, driven by consumption, no depth, all this stuff. And so, you know, like works by Andy Warhol, or I mentioned Jeff Koons or Damien Hirst, all drew attention to this, that culture had now just become pop culture and there was no distinction between any of these things. Robert Venturi, I think his name was, he wrote a book basically saying that the aesthetics of Las Vegas are, you know, basically just as good as Michelangelo, you know what I mean? So like there was a sort of celebration of kitsch and the way that, yeah, just appreciating that we lived in a fully consumeristic and superficial society. But the problem with it, right, is that if you make work to draw attention to that, you have to make work that is itself superficial and shallow, right? So the balloon dog is a send-up of, you know, just shallow culture. But in the process, you're just making more shallow culture, right? And so this becomes a kind of problem where you're not really able to get outside the critique of postmodernism. And folks like David Foster Wallace, who's considered by many to be like a very early forerunner of metamodernism, really, you know, put his finger on this problem that when you use irony and cynicism, you just wind up making things worse. And so the only way kind of out of the trap of critique is to start affirming things, you know, to risk the rolled eyes and the kind of yawn and the, oh, how banal is that, right? So much of postmodern art was about shock and squalor and surprise. And there was this desire to disturb people.
Would you include a punk in that?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I mean, that's kind of, you know, punk and grunge was sort of an angry response to these dynamics that young people were seeing.
Rejection.
And rejecting it, for sure. Radiohead, I would also put in that category. Now, Radiohead, I mean, I love Radiohead's music, but it's thoroughly postmodern. It's all of its lyrics are just dripping with this irony, right? You know, everything in its right place is like this send up of how people think in the suburban world that they're critiquing. But again, if you just wind up creating all this art that is itself cynical and doesn't move beyond its own critique. So the work I was writing at the time was not in that vein. And so when I discovered people talking about metamodernism, I got really excited. At the time, they were just talking about this new surge in the arts where people seem to be taking a stand on values and being willing to, you know, make claims about things knowing they're probably wrong and having sort of the risk now became being earnest. Before it used to be, oh, we're cool because we're cynical and skeptical. Now it was becoming cool to be earnest and maybe even a little hokey. And so this was this aesthetic shift that people started to notice, and it didn't conform to the postmodern paradigm anymore. So people were like, we have to theorize this differently. And so that's where the term metamodernism really comes from and gets going from. There was a sense, though, and I think this is the key, and it's a key part to the way I frame this in my book, this turn to sincerity and earnestness and single entendre principles, as David Foster Wallace called it. It wasn't an earnestness that was truly naive. It was aware of the fact that it was being earnest, right? It was aware of the fact that it could be cynical. It knows what cynicism is. It grew up with cynicism and skepticism, but it's going to be earnest anyway. So it's not just a return.
Or as in your book, innocent beyond complexity.
Yeah, it's this sort of second naivete. It's this informed naivete, as the metamodern scholars would talk about it. And it is. It's the return of a kind of simplicity, or the ability to be simple and immediate and sort of unreflective as a product of reflection itself. And so this sort of new paradigm really spoke to me aesthetically. A lot of the sort of art that I naturally enjoyed, Wes Anderson films and certain kinds of folk music and whatnot. And it was the sort of work that I myself was writing. So I really found this to be something very valuable. And so I started working within that paradigm. And since then, this whole kind of metamodern conversation has really flourished. But I'll pause there because I'm saying a lot of stuff. So maybe you want to...
Well, you've given a beautiful biographical account of opening into this, and I was intrigued and struck by, as someone who's aesthetically challenged, I'm colorblind, I'm almost tone deaf, I have almost no knowledge of the outside world. But so aesthetics, you know, is not a road I would come in by, so I'm intrigued that you did. But you've given us a beautiful account of your own opening to this metamodern face, and now maybe could you delineate what is this metamodernism that we're beginning to see emerging and hopefully we're beginning to live in?
Yeah, so the way it was initially kind of talked about was that, as I was saying, right, there's a return of sincerity and sort of a moving past irony, but through irony, there's a what's called ironic sincerity, right? That you retain a sense of that postmodern awareness, but you still act anyway. You still affirm things anyway. And because of all that, even though there's a certain kind of sense of return of things that you might have seen in these earlier, less reflective modes of thinking, they're not just simple like movements back to those things, because the way that they're showing up is sort of inflected through a new self-awareness, you could say. And so this is how metamodernism really shows up in the conversation around, you know, 2010, 2012. And that was sort of the cultural studies framing of it. And then, as I said, that was really insightful and very helpful for me. And there, I could give, you know, more aesthetic examples of this, but it does show up in the arts, as we could also say many other worldviews do as well, right? When you look at the early Renaissance, it's not just that new kinds of thinking and philosophy and science are being done. It's that you're seeing the emergence of new kinds of art, and that there's something about the artist as being sort of a forerunner of some of these modes of thinking. Postmodernism itself, you could identify certain early forms of, going all the way back to the Dadaists, you know, in the early 20th century, or even the early Impressionists, who were all about sort of perspective, right? So there's something about the artist showing up first and enacting this thing kind of just intuitively that then people start to reflect upon and start to theorize about. Then Hansi Freinach's works, which were mentioned earlier, those show up around 2017. And what happens with those is Hansi Freinach, this figure who is writing this kind of metamodern philosophy, picks up the term that's going on in this cultural conversation and brings some more theorizing to it. And a lot of that theory is informed by integral philosophy. And so a lot of that is kind of bringing some of the cultural evolution lens to this, and it's bringing a developmental lens to this. So that happens in a big way, and that adds a whole new layer and sense of depth to this, and also is where the integral and metamodern conversation starts to link up in an interesting way. But then...
And I would add positive responses to these very negative things that postmodernism revealed.
Yes.
Clearly.
Yeah.
And Hansi is putting it back together in a way that this is a way that gives us hope. This is a way, the Listening Society.
Exactly.
There's really great ideas. Bildung is another fantastic idea that was brought forward in that.
Yep.
So I think that's a good example of what you're talking about, as far as a postmodern still being kind of cynical, but at the same time, the good, the true, the beautiful, hope, positivity.
Yeah. That sensibility runs throughout all forms of metamodern thinking, that there is a move from cynicism, skepticism, doubt to hope and value and belief and this aspirational idealism of some kind. So there is this move from the negative to the positive in a very real way in all forms of metamodernism. And yeah, that kind of radical perspectival relativism that postmodernism had introduced starts to become, let's say, organized in a coherent way by this new kind of metamodern framing. And again, informed by various forms of integral thought in the process, where actually, if yes, we can recognize that everything has a perspective, everything's coming from a particular angle on reality, but that doesn't mean that we're just floating in a chaotic realm of different perspectives without any ability to relate them to each other. We can actually relate perspectives one to the other.
Or that all perspectives are equally valuable. I mean, some perspectives come from a higher place of complexity and serve more than other perspectives.
Exactly. And this is where a lot of the complexity thinking really enters in a big way, where, gosh, I mean, it's hard to know where to even begin to try to summarize all these things. I guess, obviously, you know, if people are interested in this, they can read the book, because I try to offer a synthesis of all the metamodern stuff that starts to show up and try to suggest the kind of deep gestalt or unifying framework that brings it all together in a coherent way. But I guess I would just note that, like, what I found interesting and fascinating about this metamodern moment was that there were multiple people independently using this term, and yet they were all seemingly converging upon very similar ideas. Jason Ananda Josephson Storm, who's a philosopher and an historian and involved in a religious studies department at Williams College, he writes a systematic philosophy, which he calls metamodernism, which is a future of theory. And he's coming at it from a very different direction than Hansi Freinach or the early cultural theorists, and yet comes to very similar kinds of orientations about things. And I think it was, Roger, you mentioned earlier, the negation of the negation. That is a big framing that Storm's work brings to all this, because you can look at postmodernism as this negation of what had been. You know, it's a post-reflection on modernity. It's this critique. It's this skepticism and cynicism about it. And Storm calls that philosophy under the sign of the negative. Everything is interrogated and taken apart and deconstructed and tried to see, you know, what's wrong here and all that. But what's interesting about that move is you can carry it through so far that it winds up kind of flipping over on itself. If you negate negation, you get something positive, which again is this metamodern move away from negativity towards positivity and towards hope from, you know, melancholy and despair. And so, point being, there is a very rich set of ideas that start to show up onto the scene, all around the same time, 2017, 2020, 2021, this whole period. And this really kind of has a sense of, you know, cultural intensity to it, a kind of movement around it. And there's some deep stuff operating at the philosophical level, at the aesthetic level. And it seems like the dawn of a new kind of worldview. And so that is sort of in rough outline some of the contours of the metamodern moment. But then, you know, depending on how deep into this you want to go, we can try to talk about what are some of the deeper ideas and the logic behind all this and the stuff I get into my book.
Do you see that there's any progress in inseminating the metamodern into the very, very postmodern academic culture that we found on our campuses?
I think it's absolutely necessary. And I'm trying to do a lot of work around this myself. You know, a lot of, and Storm's work focuses on this issue probably the most. So much of what's happened in academia is that our categories and fields of knowledge have been deconstructed. So if you take an anthropology class, which is ostensibly about human culture, one of the first things you'll do is learn that culture is a problematic term and doesn't exist. If you do what I did, which is study religion, you will spend most of your 4 years exploring how religion is a made-up category that, you know, needs to be deconstructed, and so on and so forth, right? You study art, and then you get into the issue of what is art and who decides, and isn't this a power play to separate high and low and all this stuff. So most of the humanities especially have witnessed this sort of deconstructive process that Storm makes a point is reaching just radically diminishing returns at this point. Even though people aren't using the term postmodernism so much, it's still the case that the kind of standard operating procedure to write a thesis or a work or whatever is to take a topic, see how you can break it down, break it up, deconstruct it, and then sort of leave it in rubble. And now you get your PhD. And so that is having not just intellectual sort of issues with stymieing, stultification, or at least stunting of, you know, intellectual progress. It's also having cultural impacts too, because this stuff leaks out into culture. People come out of the university sort of disillusioned profoundly, thinking everything is just, you know, an object of power analysis and this sort of a thing. Anyway, long story short, yes, the university system has become just thoroughly saturated with postmodern thought and isn't productively generating much, to the point where it's produced a profound legitimization crisis for the humanities themselves. And now humanities departments their funding's getting cut, and they can't tell you why it shouldn't be, because what are their topics of study anyway? So long story short, yeah, we need a paradigm shift. We need a future for theory that moves us beyond the impasses of postmodern deconstruction. And that is what metamodernism would offer. So especially Jason Storm's work is essential reading for people who care about this topic, because my hope is that this really will begin to get some traction in the academy. I'm working with Jason on an academic journal called Metamodern Theory and Praxis, and we are hoping for that to be sort of the first, you know, gesture in this direction. And there are some promising signs that things are starting to move, you know, more in that direction. I think the more that we see things deteriorate, we will start to see also more hopefully constructive responses as people say, hey, this really isn't working. Things are falling apart. We've really got to shift gears. I get emails almost, let's say, weekly from people saying, hey, I'm studying metamodernism for my architecture thesis or for my this or that, right? So this is starting to make its way into the academy in a big way. And I think that that's very encouraging.
I'm relieved to hear that. And you just gave a beautiful account of the way in which metamodernism has undermined the academic enterprise. And I want to just point to something you are very aware of, and maybe you'll invite you to speak to. The way it has leaked into the culture in ways which are also destructive. I think of, for example, the way certain cynical politicians have picked up on the idea of no truth, etc. And fake news is now, you know, everything, so much is being undermined. And also something that Ken Wilber wrote very eloquently about is the fact that we now, for the first time in history, have four major worldviews or developmental stages operating in our culture at the same time, and that so many of our cultural conflicts actually express not just different perspectives at the same level, but unrecognized cross-level warfare. The cultural warfare, or the cultural conflicts reflect so much the fact of different developmental stages, different worldviews, different cultural moments not being recognized. Love to have you speak to that.
Yeah. And I mean, you could go even further. I think Hanzi's work is helpful for this to appreciate. It's not just that there are different worldviews of different complexity levels all interacting, you know, across each other, but that individuals at different levels of, you could say, psychological complexity are also operating worldview systems that are beyond their ken, you know, intellectually, you could say. And so it's not just that different worldviews are clashing based on their ideas. It's that different worldviews are getting picked up and sort of oversimplified and confused at levels that aren't really properly able to operate those operating systems. And, you know, I think there's a good case to be made that a lot of the culture wars stem from maybe even largely or majority of that dynamic where, you know, you're 18 years old, you go to university, and then you're told that, you know, basically you've got to deconstruct everything and everything's just power and everything's oppression and this sort of a thing. 18 is probably not the level at which you're fully ready or able to really digest, you know, the depths of deconstructive theory and the full range of complexity of the histories of colonialism and this sort of a thing. You're just presented with it and then it gets kind of downward assimilated. And then what it winds up doing is kind of getting acted out in a way that is actually kind of psychologically at a level much more like, you know, sort of traditional dogma, basically. So postmodernism becomes the new dogma for a lot of people, or traditionalism. There's a million ways this plays out. And Corey David Barker talks about diagonal complexity. It's not just vertical or horizontal. It's these ways that things get, yeah, kind of mutated across different levels of complexity. So all of that is going on, and we have a very messy situation with a lot of permutations, let's just say, in incalculable numbers of permutations going on with the relationship of individuals and collective worldview systems, you know, that seem to be challenging one another. So yeah, that's the big challenge. I do think that metamodernism offers some tools to be able to help us navigate that dynamic. One, just by making us aware of that way of framing the issue, which remains blind, you know, which many people remain blind to because they just see different people's perspectives, right? And so there's a framing that itself can help bring some clarity. But I think one of the biggest things is that we, even though there's all this stuff that's incredibly valuable to be brought in from the postmodern framework, a lot of which we've already spoken to, there are also ways in which its logic has reached a sort of dead end or cul-de-sac, or, you know, it reaches a limit that then it needs to transcend, in the same way that I reached a limit with my traditional religion that I had to transcend and break through in order to get somewhere that could be more adaptive for me. And so we're kind of there collectively with a lot of the postmodern forms of thought. And so we see that playing out politically, where we've deeply collectively internalized the notion that everyone's just coming from a different perspective, and therefore, who's to say, essentially. And also, people have taken to heart that power seems to be the only kind of adjudicating factor here. So we wind up caring a lot about the words people use, because some people think we can just fix society if we change the words. We have also people trying to get control of power, you know, political power, in order to basically just silence their detractors. All those are obviously pathological responses to these issues. And I think that we're just seeing that the fissuring into micro narratives and the rejection of truth is not working. And another big factor, I think, that's really catalyzed this is that postmodernism used to be a kind of framework that a primarily leftist politics used for emancipatory reasons, right? You would try to pick up notions of deconstruction so that you could show and that
also atheistic with the far kind of left.
Sure. Yep. Yes. Yeah. And so that was sort of the general thrust of the postmodern approach, was to, yeah, deconstruct things in order to try to undermine what was deemed oppressive power structures, let's say. But one of the things that's happened in a big way over the past 10 years is that postmodernism as a general intellectual toolkit is now being employed very much by the right. And you mentioned political figures talking about alternative facts and, you know, just the kind of nonchalance about anything having to do with reality, everything being superficial. There's no depth. Everything is. So I think one of the
choose your own facts or make them up.
Exactly. And so I think that the sort of intellectual, the kind of leftist intelligentsia were a bit shocked when they wound up being hoisted by their own petard with a lot of these tools of deconstruction and relativization and whatnot, in a way that now those on the left really care a lot about truth. You know, democracy dies in darkness, and we need our journalists to fight against the encroachments of democracy and this sort of a thing. All of which I'm very sympathetic to, right? But it's a bit ironic at this point that we've seen this shift, towards new deployments of postmodern thought, in a way that now there are new reactions to postmodern thought, and people are starting to care a lot more about truth. So all those things are going on right now in a way that is leading to some pretty devastating effects in our kind of culture more broadly. And yeah, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, so, and I guess one of the last things I'll say about how metamodernism brings some clarity to this too, is that it recognizes that doesn't work. That even though, you know, grand narratives of truth might be dangerous, as the postmodernists realize, they also seem to be necessary to some degree if we're going to have a working social organization of whatever that is, a community or a nation that can have a shared sense of reality. We can't all be working with radically different micro narratives. We need some kind of a shared narrative, something to unite the disintegrated notion of reality. And so rather than a sort of grand narrative being seen as something inherently oppressive, the way postmodernists used to see it, it's starting to become clear that we actually use narratives to bring us together, that there can be healthy and salutary ways that truth and even power can be deployed for the good of people. So a lot of that cynicism and skepticism is starting to fall away as people adopt more metamodernist stances of trying to listen to each other. You mentioned the listening society. You know, trying to, in Storm's work, he talks about reaffirming values again, not just saying what we're against, but what are we for, right? This is a big thing. The problem, right, is that when people say they're for something, then you've opened yourself up to critique and attack. And yet now it's sort of the vanguard of people who are willing to take the risk of actually saying, these are my values. And these have been values that we've been operating from in the past. We've kind of hidden them or put them underground. So yeah, I could go on and I don't mean to, you know, talk so much, but it's a very rich topic.
Well, it's a very rich topic and very, very important. This is one of the great issues of our time, how we recognize what is going on in the cultural conflicts and miasma we're currently in, and how we find ways out. And I think you're doing extremely important work with this, bringing an understanding of a potential worldview and value system and understanding that could be very healing for our culture. And of course, as you point out beautifully in your book, Metamodernism itself will in turn be recognized as limited, and hopefully there'll be something that grows beyond it. Just as Ken Wilber's often said, integral is the biggest picture I can see on the planet at the moment, and something better, bigger and better will come. But for right now, it seems like something we really need. And it's no exaggeration to say the health and perhaps even viability of our civilization may depend on both our individual growth and maturation and our collective cultural growth and evolution to a place in which we can make sense of the enormous complexity we currently face and respond to it with at least sufficient wisdom to get us through this threat to our civilization and survival.
Yeah. One more thing I want to emphasize too about all this is that complexity is an important framework in metamodern thought, something I care a lot about. And one thing that we see with complex systems is that they form these moments of order and organization, well, you can call it tractors, right? When you've got a certain kind of, just certain kinds of dynamics that allow them to kind of find this little island of coherence. But if the conditions change, that's going to begin to destabilize. And what you can see then is either basically a breakdown to a less complex organizational structure or a breakthrough to a more complex organizational structure. And the challenge right now collectively for us all is that we're seeing a lot of breakdown and we're seeing a lot of moving back to less complex framing devices for understanding reality, which is just another way of talking about certain kinds of regressive and reactionary modes of thought that become really attractive to people when things are really chaotic and disturbed and uncertain. And so this has been really one of my most important emphases that I and one of the things that attracts me so much to a metamodern framing is because it is trying to move us through and beyond these issues towards a more complex outcome. But what I see so much of is the danger of this seeking for comfort in modes of thinking that are not of sufficient complexity to meet the nature of the challenges that we face as a collective. And so there has recently been a huge kind of upswell in certain parts of, well, there's just in general terms, you could just say there's been an upswell in returns to certain forms of religious thinking that I think we can try to engage but move forward into more complex formulations. Whereas if people are looking for, I don't know, a bit more certainty and a bit more kind of dogma that they can feel comfortable in, that's certainly an understandable orientation, but ultimately that's going to cause more disruption and destabilization down the line in the kind of complex world that we're living in. So I think it's absolutely essential that people, some folks anyway, can try to, you know, break through to this other way of seeing that can hopefully get us beyond the limits of our worldviews at the moment and help kind of, yeah, get us through and beyond our current hangups in a way that allows us to keep moving forward rather than kind of falling back. So maybe that's a obvious or trite point, but it's something I see so much of right now, and it makes me, yeah, concerned. So a big part of my work is aimed at trying to address that problem.
Well, it's a very profound and vital concern, and thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah, I wanted to share something the other day in preparing for this conversation. I've been, digging into your work and podcasts online and stuff like that. But I'd also been reading about the reproducibility issue in science, that they found out that 75% of the articles that were published in these very prestigious peer-reviewed journals in science weren't reproducible.
Mm.
And in psychology, same thing, the journals, peer-reviewed, et cetera, were about 60%.
Hmm.
So it creates a complete, crisis. What can we believe anymore? And partially systemic, perish or public, publish or perish,
right,
academia, and especially in these highly regarded magazines, and what they want are positive results.
Mm-hmm.
So people will not write papers on the negative results, but just and keep doing the experiment until they get the result they want. And there's also the issue of the observer affects the observed.
Mm.
You get often what you're looking for. And we know in quantum physics, you look at one of these entities in one way, it's a wave that stretches out to infinity, then, or it's a discrete particle. So what does that do to the whole idea of objective science and science itself? And I went meta on it. And what I came up with is that when you're looking at these experiments, not only do you have to consider the object of the experiment, you have to consider the experimenter and what they bring to it. What is their paradigm? What is their, what are the financials? What are the what are they expecting to find? And what are they putting into it? So when you get it to the next level, all of a sudden, to me, I was like, well, this is a brave new world, but it's very encouraging. Mm. You just have to include both sides and look at it in a more equal and a nuanced meta way, if you will. And it's kind of this stuff works. I had my moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's always the move that we want to try to do. And that's, is that meta move, which is, all right, weren't we taking into account that we need to take into account? And I think that postmodernism, raised the question, but it was sort of an incomplete turn, because its initial response, if there was one, was we can't know, everything is kind of inherently flawed or prejudiced or biased or what have you. But that's only a half turn. It's sort of like seeing the problem, but then just skewing towards, I guess it's fundamental. But actually, it's not a fundamental problem per se. It's a relative problem. If we can expand our scope enough, then we can try to integrate more of, the factors, the variables that are influencing the kinds of science that we should be doing. And then we can actually be doing better science.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's the sort of move that we should be doing everywhere, is trying to factor in more of the system itself. And this gets us to, again, kind of systems thinking or meta systems thinking, where we need to apply the logic of systems to be able to more appropriately do knowledge creation. A lot of classic sort of scientific knowledge production in sort of the STEM fields is largely about sort of linear relationships, right? Isolate the variable and see exactly what, you know, what the natural relationship is between this variable and a given outcome versus a control, et cetera. And that's very kind of linear in thinking. But as you say, what the scientist is then missing from their scope is that they are a scientist and they are doing an experiment and they have a context they're operating in. And let's just say the impact that their work is having is part of a system that they are themselves enmeshed in. So it's actually a nonlinear system. And that it becomes increasingly difficult because it becomes increasingly complex to appreciate all the dynamics that wind up getting folded in here. But those are the sorts of moves that we can do to then say, oh, okay, if I want to do better science, I need to be considering more of the full scope of the experiment, you could say, which isn't just limited to my Petri dish or what have you. It's actually limited to the entire laboratory and actually the laboratory in, as being enmeshed in a, you know, cultural knowledge production system, et cetera, et cetera. And that's pretty key. And so some of the metamodern frameworks like the unified theory of knowledge that Greg Enriquez has developed starts to do those sorts of things by putting the knower in the context of the known and helps us get a view from complexity, at least. So, yeah.
And I think you just gave us a great summary. And of course, there'd be many possible summaries of the value that you're bringing in with your metamodernism. That is an encouragement to look at more of the picture, both in terms of the content, but also recursively looking back at the perspective from which we're looking and looking at ourselves. And Brendan, this has been an extraordinary conversation, just so very rich. And we could obviously keep going, but I guess we have to acknowledge our limits. But is there anything else you'd like to add?
Maybe just to piggyback quickly on that last thought you brought up as a way of tying it all together, which is that one of the things I try to talk about in the book is that metamodernism is a worldview of worldviews, or it's a cultural logic of cultural logics. It is doing that recursive thing of trying to kind of expand beyond the frame that we've been working in, which has reached its limits, to try to see what else is going on. And what it discovers is that what's going on is this process of recursive reflection. And if we take that process seriously, it can point the path forward to more productive avenues of thought. And that actually you can even make the case, I think, very compellingly, that this is what cultural evolution has always been about, what it's been doing, how it's been unfolding, that the modern thought shows up, objectifies the pre-modern, reflects on it, critiques it, and tries to transcend it. The postmodern thought shows up, you know, objectifies the modern thought, reflects upon it, critiques it, tries to transcend it, and so on. That there is always this sort of looking over our shoulder at what has been, what were the limits, what wasn't being accounted for, how do we tie things into greater networks of relationality and try to build that into a more comprehensive system. And then when that system reaches its limits, we have to deconstruct it to try to get beyond that system, go outside of it and find something more comprehensive and encompassing. And that's a very different picture of cultural evolution than the sort you'll get in, for example, you know, Harari's Sapiens, which just says, things change and there's not really any way we can look at any of this as, you know, going anywhere or saying anything or related to value. I think that it gives a new sense, a new narrative about our history and about who we are and what we're up to, that I think is a hopeful narrative and it is an aspirational one, and it has a directionality that can allow us to move beyond the kind of radical relativism and the fragmented, fractured micro narratives of postmodernism to a framework where we can actually relate to each other in deeper ways and find deeper modes of understanding and compassion and empathy with one another from that frame. And so I'm hopeful that that's where the future is tending.
May it be so. And Brendan, you are certainly doing wonderful work to encourage that, the very evolution which you're describing and analyzing. And I have to say, this is a potentially incredibly complex topic, and both John and I were so impressed that you managed to make metamodernism and cultural evolution come alive in a lively, clear way in your own book, Metamodernism, or the Cultural Logic of Cultural Logics. And you have, of course, your podcast, Metamodern Spirituality. You have other books. So you are quite a resource. And thank you so much for being with us. It's really been a mind-opening discussion and a very rich one, and hopefully a real contribution to the very evolution you're describing.
Thank you so much.
And I just want to hold up the mirror for you that the depth of your scholarship is really astounding.
Thank you.
Really amazing. And I also sense that the purity of your motivation or your heart is really, really good too. So you put, you know, the brain and the heart together, and in some schools that's called enlightenment. So you're bringing very enlightened views and energy into this conversation. And I really hope that your voice grows and you've got so much to contribute, and it's very meaningful.
I deeply appreciate that, and I'm honored to hear all of that. And I guess I would just also humbly say that I feel very much that I'm just synthesizing a lot of the profound insights of many other people who have come before. And that's really a lot of the whole idea of it, really, is a reflection on what's been and trying to carry that forward. And so I hope these works that I'm putting out are helpful and are doing what you say and helping to evolve things in that direction. But I feel like I'm only just sort of a messenger and someone trying to communicate and distill and spread these ideas that I have been the beneficiary of from so many other thinkers, especially from the integral tradition and others. So that's very kind of you to say. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. This has been great.
Yeah, ditto, ditto. Thank you, Brendan.
Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it's very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.